Good morning. Is it still 11 below out there? Or has it been warming up to 9 below or something? This is the second Sunday in a row I've given a talk. And last Sunday, it was too snowy for people to come. This Sunday, it's too cold, but you guys made it. So, good for you. I'm going to talk, this is my second talk on the hindrances in Buddhism. These are difficult energies which arise in the mind and in life as part of meditation practice. My first talk, I talked about desire, and today I'm going to talk about aversion or dislike, sloth and torpor, or laziness, if you want to call it that, but that has a pretty negative connotation, and restlessness. And then the last one is doubt, and I'm going to talk about that in the sesshin that I lead 3 weeks from this weekend, the traditional sesshin. I'll talk about it on Saturday and Sunday. So difficult energies which arise in the mind, my mind and yours, and in life as part of meditation practice. And when Buddha, when I talked about the first one, I talked about Buddha's analogy, his metaphor of the poison tree. The poison tree. When there's a poison tree, what we want to do is chop it down and try to get rid of it. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Because it's got an immense root system. And it sprouts in many, many different ways. So, supposedly the historical Buddha said instead we could do two things with the poison tree. One, we could put a sign near the tree that says, this is a poison tree. Don't eat the berries. Don't eat the leaves. And instead of killing it, we can take shade in it. We don't need to touch it. Just take shade in it rather than freak out. Try to cut it down. Or we can say, oh, a poison tree. Just what I've been looking for. These berries make the best medicine for curing my psychological and spiritual maladies. So, those are his two pieces of advice in regard to that metaphor. So I'm going to talk first about aversion, and then move on to the next one, and then the next one. Aversion. So, what about this Minnesota winter, you guys? Anybody experience any aversion at all? Or are all of you just hardy, hardy Minnesotans? When my wife complains or when I complain, we remind each other of what it was like when we came here 40 years ago and we lived in northern Minnesota. That's a very faint memory. But aversion to the cold, to the snow, to figuring out how to even get somewhere without getting stuck. Aversion to getting here to meditate. Is it worth it to come all the way here to meditate? It's too cold. Too cold to go to Zen Center, and I don't like sitting at home. I've never sat at home. I've always sat at a Zen Center. It's hard for me to sit at home. I have aversion to that. So what do we say? We say, I shouldn't be resistant. I wish my thoughts about not wanting to sit would go away. And what happens when we try to make them go away? Well, they go away for a little while, right? Well, maybe for a minute, or maybe for a day, or maybe our practice is really good for a whole week, and they come back. So chopping the tree down doesn't work. Instead, every time we hear the voice saying, we're not doing meditation right, or we should do more, or we can just sit, and we can actually maybe count the judgments, count the number of times that you say that to yourself. Now, I've suggested this to a couple people in one-to-ones recently, and they just looked at me like I was weird. Count the judgments. But counting the judgments is a way of distancing yourself and not being caught by them. It's just a way, just one way. Count them. count them. Just notice. Just play with it. Don't do it in a too serious way. Just play with it. Or maybe if that doesn't work, thank the judgment. So there it is. There it comes. Up again. Oh, thank you. That might work for a while. May or may not. But aversion is natural. We all have aversion. If you didn't have some aversion during this Minnesota winter, I would think you were on something. Big time. Big time, right? So someone said to me a while ago in a one-to-one, do you remember the times when you really just wanted to pick your kids up and throw them out the window and you didn't care? And I thought, no. Boy, that's reversion. That's dislike. But then I went home and I did remember a few times. and I was embarrassed even to have that memory coming up. But that's embarrassment, aversion, embarrassment. So acknowledge this energy, this aversive energy, this negative energy. Acknowledge that it's come up. Name it, if it helps. Name your fury at your kids or your dog or whomever, your parent, and be aware of it. Let yourself touch it with your heart, okay? With your heart. Connect with it from a place of tenderness, a place of caring. Make friends with your anger so you can make friends again with your kids, if it's your kids or your dog or your whoever it is. If we can't let things into our heart, we don't really let ourselves grow. Instead of trying to get over our aversion or get rid of it, eat the berries on the tree. And underlying aversion is often fear, generally fear. So years ago, the nested eating bowls were introduced into the San Francisco Zen Center where I'm from. They're called Orioki. How many of you have had experience with Orioki? Less than half of you. Well, if you want to have an Orioki experience, then just come to the session that I'm leading 3 weeks from today. Orioki are traditional nested eating bowls, and they help us meditate by being very precise in the way we move and the way we eat. They're beautiful, a beautiful kind of a mini version of a tea ceremony, and just helps us attend to each aspect of our eating. But anyway, when they were introduced, I was a young man. I'd been practicing Zen for about 3 or 4 years, and I thought, "What? What's this? We just always ate with knives and forks." And then I saw that there was only one way to do them, and that was the right-handed way. And I'm left-handed, so that was aversive for me. I was left-handed, and the Japanese teacher said, "Oh no, we don't do left-handed." What do you mean we don't do left-handed? I'm left-handed. So very hard for me. Very hard. And aversive. We had a session like the one I'm going to be doing, a traditional treat coming up in Tassajara, actually, where I was living. And during the whole two sittings in the morning, I was just ruminating about having to do it. Talk about aversion, talking about dislike. I think, oh no, everybody's going to see me. I'm going to be clunky. I'm on the display. Aversion, aversion. And plus, my wife was the Orioki teacher, so that really made double aversion, triple aversion. Because in this case, I was afraid of being poorly thought of. So we notice these things about ourselves. We're social beings. We're social animals. And we dislike being in situations where we're poorly thought of. We dislike it. We dislike it. So when we're experiencing any of these, but I'm starting with aversion, there are different things we can do. And there are two types of classic classical meditation, Buddhist meditation. The first is bare awareness, mindfulness, shikantaza. That's when you just pay attention to everything, to everything. You're not trying to focus. You're just being here, paying attention to the sounds, the sensations, the thoughts, the feelings. You're just paying attention. And the other type is focus meditation, where you're focusing on your breath or repeating something to yourself with your breath or saying a loving kindness meditation. You're focusing. So if you're doing a bare awareness meditation, a mindful meditation, a shikantaza, and then your thoughts about doing the nested eating bowls, for instance, come up, then you can narrow your focus. Oh, because they're dominating everything. So I narrow my focus on saying something like, maybe okay on the in-breath, okay on the out-breath, or something. I choose my own words, or something. You find what comes up for you, and you narrow your focus so that you're not caught by that anymore. Or if you're doing a narrow focus meditation on your breathing, repeating something with your breathing, or on your hara, on your lower belly, or what we call your cosmic mudra, then you can broaden it. You can broaden it because the thoughts are interfering with your breathing. They're interfering so much that your breathing is getting constricted. So you can broaden out by including the sounds around you, all the sensations in your body, and even let the emotion of scared come up. So narrowing your focus or broadening your focus. And maybe the person next to you is breathing like a steam engine during meditation, which may be okay for one meditation, but when you have to sit in a whole retreat and someone is breathing like a steam engine next to you, it's aversive. It's aversive. So can you narrow your focus a little bit to include something that soothes you, or can you broaden your focus out beyond the breathing to include the sounds outside and sensations in your body? Or can you change your focus in another way, any other way? So I've been giving these Dharma talks for many, many years. And at first, when I gave my talks, I wanted my talks to be successful. Of course I did. Of course I still want to be successful. But, I mean, I was focused on them being successful then. And so I was nervous because I wanted my talks to be successful. So my focus on preparing and then coming in the room and then being, am I being successful? Am I being successful? But gradually, I changed my focus. Instead of trying to be successful, I focused on how I can support you. I looked at Jim. I thought, well, how can I support him? I looked at Dennis. And that helped me. So no longer did I have that focus on being successful. I focused on just being with people and looking at them and seeing, as I watched them, how I could best support them. Because you can learn a lot by watching somebody, a whole bunch. And if you're feeling nervous, just watching them, you don't feel nervous anymore because you see what's going on with them and how to support them in some intuitive way. So change your focus in some other way. And the second one, sloth and torpor. Or laziness, if you want to say. I think laziness is a part. They say sloth and torpor in this translation of the Sanskrit, but laziness. We think laziness is bad, but it's just what is. We have sloth and torpor sometimes. You come to sit here, and you've been sitting for a while, and you've gotten rid of the first hindrance desire. You're no longer desiring so much to get out of here. And you've got rid of aversion. Your body isn't paining you too much, and you're breathing. So if you've gotten rid of desire and aversion, what's left? Sloth and torpor. Usually we have desire or we have aversion, so we don't experience sloth and torpor, right? And that's the next. That's why it's the third one, because once we pass through those, we're on our cushion, we're slothful and torporous, in case you haven't noticed. Or we're slothful and torporous because I'm too tired to sit. I'm too stressed out to sit. I'm too overburdened with all these thoughts and worries to sit. I'm too agitated to sit. But that's exactly when you need to do something meditative. That's exactly when you need to do something meditative. All of the research on a sense of hopelessness, a sense of even mini depression, is that these things that we least feel like doing is what we have to do for our mental and spiritual health. The pillars of mental and spiritual health: diet, exercise, heart connection with people, and meditation. And meditation has just been added the last 10 years. But I feel lucky about that. Finally, it got added. Well, now it seems to be acknowledged, you know, that it's an essential pillar. So sometimes we experience sloth and torpor because we don't have a sense of direction. We lack direction. And when we lack direction, we don't have a lot of energy. You know, we don't know where we're going. We don't have a goal. We don't have an aspiration. And then we lack energy. So my first years when I was a meditator, I experienced a lot of sloth and torpor. Although I don't think I even knew those words. We could say a lot of feelings of laziness. A lot of feelings of laziness. But my teacher, I came to his talks every Sunday and every Wednesday night, twice a week. And he kept saying, each of us could discover our own Buddha nature. And of course, what does Buddha nature mean? It means our own stillness inside, our own timelessness, right in here. And I just mostly believed him, and when I disbelieved him, then I came back again. And I just did it over and over. And people said, "Oh, you're very disciplined." But actually, I'm not a disciplined person. Ask my wife. I'm not a disciplined person. I simply believe that if I did this, I could tap into what Suzuki Roshi called my Buddha nature, my still nature. And when I doubted it, I came back and he told it to me again, and I was stupid enough to believe him. It's good to be kind of stupid when you do this practice. I believed that I could become more alive and more authentic. Sometimes sloth and torpor is a reaction to a chronic habit of tension and anxiety, or being chronically excited, with days of stress or months of stress or even years of stress. Finally, you're just sitting facing the wall. You're completely still, and you feel the exhaustion from this chronic tension. But you hadn't even noticed that because you're going, going, going. So then you sit down and you look at the wall, and you feel that. You feel that exhaustion. So that's good. That's good. That's a transition. It's a little bit like coffee withdrawal. Coffee withdrawal from the chronic habit of tension, the chronic habit of anxiety, of excitement. And then you have no energy. That's right. You're withdrawing. You're sitting in the wall. There's nothing. And that's good. I know it doesn't feel good to be on a coffee withdrawal, but after a while, you get cleared out. Same for this go, go, go withdrawal, this nervous energy withdrawal. And first you feel slothful. Because you don't have that anymore. And especially that's why it's good to do a retreat. Do some retreats here. We have retreats every month. Because you get a sense of this. A sense of this. And in retreats, it's natural to have sleepiness because you have no stimulation, no entertainment for, you know, a half day or a whole day. And you're just sitting. So it's natural because It's natural. You can feel like a sloth in a retreat, and then the bell rings for lunch, and all of a sudden, you're not a sloth. All of a sudden, you've got all this energy, all this enthusiasm. So that's teaching you something, right? It's teaching you something about your own psyche. So, as with aversion, with sloth, we can narrow our focus, we can broaden our focus, we can change our focus. Also, we can notice how thoughts increase our energy or decrease it. Notice how focusing on failures decreases your energy, right? Feared failures decreases your energy. Thinking, oh, there's 20 minutes left in this sitting. How am I going to get through it? This is awful. I could never get through it. Oh, there's still 18 minutes left. Oh, no. That decreases your energy. Oh, you get more. But what about saying, oh, I'm going to pay attention to the next breath. Or I'm going to do 10 breaths. Oh, I'm going to do 10 breaths. Oh, no, I'm going to do another 10 breaths. That thought increases your energy, right? And this is not just about meditation, it's about everything in life. Notice how your cognitions affect you. Notice it. So the last one I want to talk about is restlessness. Restlessness. So when we sit on the cushion facing a wall or facing the back of the head of our person in front of us, we very quickly create our own entertainment. We very quickly see, oh, I have time to plan what I'm going to cook for dinner. Finally. Oh, I have time to plan the rest of my winter, the rest of my life. Nothing is pinging on me now. Finally, I have time, right? Oh, I have time to indulge in my favorite fantasy, whatever that may be. So that's interesting. That's interesting. You got all the way in here on a cold day. You did your sitting, and then you sat and did that. Well, you can notice that about yourself because the mind is restless. The mind is restless. And since the mind is restless, when it has nothing to do, nothing to attend to, no book, no TV, no project it has to get through by such and such a time, then it goes into restless mode. That's the nature of the mind, to go into restless mode. Well, okay, that's just the nature of the mind. Okay. So we can narrow our focus, we can broaden our focus, we can change our focus. If we're doing bare awareness, shikantaza, we can choose a focus that our restlessness doesn't find boring. I used to choose, when I lived in a busy street in San Francisco where we meditated, well, we didn't meditate on the street, we meditated in the building next to the street. When we did our meditations were at rush hour, which rush hour, you know, San Francisco 6:30 a.m. rush hour, and then 5:30 p.m. rush hour. So my mind would really get restless, right? Really restless, especially with a car zooming. So then I began counting the cars. I did. I began to deal with my restlessness. I began listening to them, noticing the different beeps, and counting the horns. That helped me. So there are all kinds of tools we can do when we're caught by our restlessness. All kinds of tools. Or we can broaden our focus. Our focus is too narrow and makes us restless. I can't stay with my breath. I can't stay with it. So then we can broaden it to the sensations in our body, to the sights, to the sounds, to the feelings, and even to the thoughts. This is what my teacher Suzuki says. If you cause a taming your sheep or your cow, taming your sheep or your cow, he says, to tame your sheep or your cow, give it a large pasture. I say that to people a lot of times, but they don't believe me. They think, oh no, I can see them registering, and they're saying to themselves, I can't do that. If I do that, my mind would just go wild, and I would just waste my life. I would waste my time. Well, try it, actually. If you just don't judge it at all, and just let it all be there, then you discover that it begins to subside, and there's some stillness at the center. But you have to really let the sheep and the cows do whatever they want, without interfering at all. And then they're tame. Because you're not trying to tame them, right? Or we can do a metta practice, a loving kindness practice toward ourselves. If we're feeling restless. May I feel safe. May I feel at ease. May I be happy. A happy mind's not restless. Did you ever notice that? When you're happy, you're not restless. You're just being here. Just being here. So repeating something like that, loving kindness can calm the mind, incline the mind naturally to kindness and acceptance. Or you can make a mental note when you're restless to come back to whatever it is you're trying to you're planning when meditation's over. And I used to sit with a Zen teacher who said, well, when you sit at home, have a notebook next to your cushion so that if something comes up that you need to remember, you just write it down and then you come back to your sitting. But of course, we don't do that because everybody would have notebooks here. Everybody would be writing half the time or maybe three-quarters of the time. But, you know, journaling is very meditative. It's very meditative if you do it in this non-judgmental way. So I've been sitting here for years, before that in San Francisco for a few years. And when there's something I need to remember, I make a mental note of it. And I've found that generally I can do up to two or three. If I do more than two or three, then it starts really messing with my mind for the whole meditation. But if I can do two or three, oh, I need to email Ben. I see. Need to talk to Ted. Need to do something with Linda. Get those three in. Then they only take 2 minutes to get them anchored. Then I can have the whole 30 minutes to meditate. So mental note is good. If it comes up in the middle, just make a mental note and then put it aside and come back. Or you can take the poison tree approach. Find the berry. Find the feeling which underlies your restlessness. What's the berry? What's the berry? Somebody was talking to me recently about being restless, worrying about their finances. No, that's interesting. And she said, I've been making a mental note every time I sit, but it doesn't work. It just keeps coming up because I'm worried about it. So I said, well, can you just notice the feeling? Can you see what the feeling is under that worry? And she said, well, it's my anxiety about being able to pay bills. I said, yeah, okay, well, it's your anxiety. Can you go into that in your meditation? Can you see what that's about? And she said, well, if I can't pay my bills, then I'm no good. Then I'm no good. And I said, oh, well, can you go into that and feel that and be with that? Open up to it in your heart. Open up to it. And if you do that, it begins to transform on its own. It really does, you guys. It begins to transform on its own. It's not something bad anymore. It's a feeling, and there are sensations that are underlying that feeling, and you can be with those. You can be with those. And you can see where it leads. So, I think that's enough for those. So I've talked, my last talk, I talked about the hindrance of desire. Today I talk about aversion, sloth and torpor, or just laziness and restlessness. The next talk I give in the Sesshin, 3 weeks from today, where we will do the nested eating bowls. They're really wonderful. Yeah, and you can go to an orientation, I think it's the night before, if you haven't done them, and learn to do them. I'll talk about doubt. So it's not the hindrances themselves that keep us from feeling content and happy. It's our response, right? It's our response. Buddha used a second metaphor about the hindrances to the poison tree, and this was grasping a hot coal. A hot coal just falls in your hand. Well, the hot coal originally doesn't burn, according to him, although I think it burns. But anyway, these metaphors we should not take too far, right? Analyze them too much. Anyway, so the hot coal falls in your hand, and maybe the hot coal is anger. But if we just let it be there and release it rather than grasping it, it doesn't burn us. So we see and release instead of holding on to. Whether it's anger, whether it's slothfulness, whether it's restlessness, we feel it and we release it. And then the stressful stories no longer dominate, because we this is a practice. We become adept at this. We become adepts at doing this. And we do it with some patience and some compassion, some self-compassion, because it's sort of so counterintuitive initially to the way we are in the world. But it's our Buddha nature. It's our still nature. And we can all tap into it. So whether it's the anger berries on the poison tree, or the sloth berries, or the laziness berries, or the restless berries, they're the medicine that the universe is giving us for curing ourselves. We're taking this difficult energy. We're working with it. We're playing with it. We're dancing with it. We're distilling it in our bodies. It's lodged in our bodies, so we're noticing it in our bodies. We're paying attention to it. We're opening up to it. And in our hearts. Until it no longer plagues us and we feel the stillness, the joy that emanates from our own Buddha nature. And you don't have to use that term Buddha nature if you don't want to. I don't care. The word isn't what it's about. It's about coming back to our own vitality right here, which is covered up by all this stuff. So that's what I want to say for this morning. And I'll be glad to take questions or comments from anybody. Yeah, okay. Yeah, go. Yeah?
This is just a comment, really, or just sharing of an experience. So I'm in practice period. And for the first time ever, I have tried a journal. And anyway, I never really realized this, but during my meditation, one of the things I do struggle with is taking a mental note. Because the deep truth is, I don't even trust myself to remember that one important thing that came up. So anyway, so I'm trying the journal. And a question came up, and you can ask me about details later if you want to know more during tea. But anyway, so I just diligently in my journal just wrote, one question after the meditation period, and then found it was really helpful to just know that that's written down and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
I had no expectation at all for answering this question.
Uh-huh.
And then 2 days later, I'm reading the material for practice period, the book, and within the first chapter is a very definite answer to my question. So I just wanted to share that, though. I think that is something probably a lot of people struggle with, of just trusting yourself to even remember it to the end of your meditation period, to even put it in a journal. So.
Well, good. That's very good. So now that you've done that once, you can do that and do that and do that. And sometimes it will fit together nicely like that, and sometimes it won't.
I suspect probably a lot of times it won't.
But that's okay. That's okay. At least you got the positive reinforcement from it, so that you can see how that can work psychically when your conscious mind gets out of the way. Your conscious mind is trying to control everything, but it just can't. The poor little thing. The poor little thing. So good. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Hey, Tim, I had a related comment to what you were saying. So what I've been doing is doing like a 10-minute meditation in the morning, and sometimes I journal afterwards. And this morning I realized sort of like the root of a lot of like my fear and anger was, you know, my family's experience in the Soviet Union, because I'm a refugee. And just like being able to put that on paper, I'm finding it was really helpful.
It was helpful to you. Yeah. Well, good. So I teach, I've only done it for 2 years. The last 2 years I've taught mindfulness at work at St. Thomas for people who come from the community from their jobs. And usually both times I had 50, 60 people. And I teach them many different types of meditation. It's all day. It starts in the morning. And including journaling. Well, when I got the evals back from last fall, as to what was the most helpful to them of all the things I did, journaling was the most helpful to them. But again, it has to be journaling in an uncensored, non-judgmental way. You have to allow yourself to write whatever happens on the page, or not write anything at all, because sometimes you'll just be putting on your pen on the page and nothing will be happening. So good. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Yeah.
So let's say you're suffering from like stress, anxiety, or like depression. How would you like take those negative energies and then turn them more positively if it's like a mental disorder that's kind of like running your life?
Well, there's really no rule for this. It would be good for you to meet one-to-one with one of the teachers and talk about this, because it depends on the nature of the anxiety, the nature of the depression. With depression generally, I'm also a retired psychologist, so excuse me. I just happen to do both. So, with depression, we tend not to eat well. The four things that we tend not to do with depression, we need to do. Eat well. Do physical activities. We feel, talk about inertia. We feel, ugh. We need to do physical activities. And, we don't want to go out and see people because it's, you know, ugh. But we need to do stuff with people. We need to make heart connection, and we need to meditate. So those are the four pillars that of mental health for people with depression. But see, actually, for anybody, it's just the problem with people of depression is that they just don't feel like doing that stuff. They don't think they have enough energy to do that stuff. And yet, when they do them, they discover they have more energy. So that's all I can say for now without meeting you one to one, which I'd be glad to do sometime.